Welcome to What Matters Now. I am Amanda Borchel-Dunn. This week, I pulled the Times of Israel editor David Horovitz away from running the site in our Jerusalem office for a rare in-depth discussion of the professional challenges and personal conflicts he's faced in covering the war against Hamas for the past half year. David gives us an unusually candid look at what it is to run a site that, following the surprise October 7th Hamas infiltration of southern Israel and massacre of 1,200 people, the site jumped 600% in its readership to become, according to Newsite Press Gazette, the fastest growing news website in the world in October and November. Our 24/7 coverage remains unchecked as we mark 6 months of war. So this week, I, Amanda Borchel-Dunn, ask Times of Israel editor David Horovitz, what matters now?
Do you or your clients have a commercial collection matter that's going nowhere? The Sarachuk Law Firm specializes in the most challenging collection matters, whether it is a single matter or a portfolio of cases. They are based in New York with relationships around the world. Sarachuk's proprietary databases and tried and proven methods have earned them an unmatched reputation for success in getting their clients what they're owed. They work on a contingency fee basis, so they're only compensated when they succeed. The Sarachuk Law Team strongly supports Israel. You can reach the Sarachuk team at www.sarachuklawfirm.com. That's S-A-R-A-C-H-E-K lawfirm.com or at 646-403-9775. The proceeding is an attorney advertisement and past results are no guarantee of future performance.
David, thank you for joining me in our Jerusalem office for an informal conversation for this week's What Matters Now.
Thanks, Amanda. Pleasure.
It's 6 months to the war, and I wonder, first of all, do you still believe that the war is existential?
I do. I think that that October 7th plunged Israel into an existential crisis. Just if you look at it in the, I suppose, what you might call the narrowest level, a neighboring entity. I mean, we call Hamas a terrorist organization, but it was a government that built an army and invaded from territory where we had no claim and murdered vast numbers of people in horrific circumstances, necessitated the internal displacement of tens of thousands more. Hezbollah opened up across the northern border with anti-tank missiles for which Israel has no rocket defense systems because they have no trajectory, so they can't be intercepted by Iron Dome and that other range of defensive weapons that we have. And therefore, that necessitated the evacuation of tens of thousands of people from the north. Many of the people have returned to the south, but many have not. It is not completely safe to live in that area, even though the IDF has been in Gaza for 6 months. Nobody can remotely contemplate safely returning to the northern border areas because Hezbollah has not been directly tackled in a significant way. It is still deployed very close to the border. Iran is circling, as we know, in the last few days and even hours. There's, you know, very, very serious talk about threats of attacks from Iran. I don't think the national sense of security has been restored. Many of the old divides that were very, very threatening even before the war about the nature of this country and where it's headed, the huge rifts have resurfaced. And in terms of the international context, our alliance with the United States is certainly under strain. The international community has shown spectacular and stunning intolerance for Israel's right to defend itself, which has real practical implications. There's a huge surge in anti-Semitism, and we are the nation state of the Jewish people. So it affects us directly. It affects us in terms of our absolute union and intertwinement with the Jewish world. So yeah, all of that to me adds up to certainly the worst crisis in the modern history of Israel. And especially because of the practical, real military threats posed by Hezbollah and ultimately by Iran, existentially threatening from a military point of view. Yeah. So, yeah, I stand by that definition, I think.
Let's pick up on Iran. And it was last week, I believe, though time is very amorphous, that Israel allegedly struck what is being described in international press as a consulate of Iran in Syria and killed several of its upper ranks in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. And many international observers describe this as poking the bear, as if Israel doesn't have enough problems, it's going after these high-ranking officers. Why do you think it is part of the existential war for Israel to go after these guard officers, or is it?
Well, there's a few things in that question, right, that go to the heart of many of the difficulties that Israel has been facing in the last few months and continues to face, including the sort of misrepresentation of some of the basics of what is going on. So the most galling example of that is the degree to which October the 7th has been airbrushed out of reporting about what's happening, as though Israel is, by some caprice, deciding to pound Gaza. You know, the government of the country next door invaded and killed lots of our people, tells the world that it wants to wipe out the entire country, and will try to do so if we can't dismantle it. So if that's not in the context for everything on the Gaza war, you're going to give people the wrong impression. So now let's take that to the example you cite of the alleged Israeli strike in Syria. Yeah, Iran is telling the world that Israel hit a consulate, and therefore the impression is created among people who are not following this closely and who may be fair-minded people. Wow, those terrible Israelis blew up a place where nice officials issue passports. Israel hit something in the Iranian embassy compound, and it killed several people, including members, as you rightly said, of the of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Al-Quds Force. This is a U.S.-designated terrorist organization, and the very senior officers that Israel allegedly killed, according to what we understand, one of them in particular, was very deeply engaged in terrorism, in orchestrating terrorism against innocent people in a sovereign country, i.e. Israel. This person had responsibility for dealings with Hezbollah, again, a globally designated terrorist organization that is seeking to destroy Israel. There was a report in the New York Times a few days ago about how Iran has been flooding the West Bank with weaponry, handguns, rifles, rocket-propelled grenades, anti-tank missiles, and so on, to try to stir up another front against Israel. It's been doing this for the past 2 years. One of the people who Israel allegedly killed was certainly responsible for the areas which, according to this New York Times report, were the routes for the smuggling of weaponry into the West Bank. Wait, now that starts to sound a little different, doesn't it? Not Israel blew up a consulate and killed some military officials. No, Israel blew up some kind of terror base in an Iranian protected embassy compound and allegedly killed a person who's been trying to get weapons to the West Bank, among other things, in order to kill civilians in the disputed West Bank and inside Israel. Again, it reflects the complexities of this conflict. It reflects the need to try to actually understand what's going on.
It's very difficult to understand where truth lies. And of course, globally, many people, especially in the social media era, believe we're in a post-truth era as well. And nobody can really have the sense of where is accurate reporting coming from in this day and age, meaning you cited the New York Times, and yet we've, in previous podcasts, especially in our daily briefing, have discussed some problematic reporting from the New York Times. So how do we know when the source is accurate or not?
Oh, look, Amanda, that's a really serious and important question. And people who are listening to this cannot see my wrinkled features, but I'm 61 years old now, and all I've ever done is journalism. So, and I've been doing journalism in Israel basically for almost 40 years. This is a conflict and a period unlike any that I have known, including as regards your question. We're dominated by a conflict, a war, between Israel and Hamas in very, very complex circumstances being fought in Gaza. And we have no genuinely independent, reliable reporting coming out of there. Now, there may be independent and accurate reporting coming out of Gaza, But there's also a lot of material coming out that you can't be sure of. And among the problems is you don't know which is which. Hey, here's an incredibly potent and serious report. Can we rely on it? Are the facts accurate? Are the facts sufficient to justify the conclusion that whoever is reporting is putting on those facts? So just to be very specific, for example, a lot of material that's all journalistic outlets use originates with news agency copy. So, you know, the Times of Israel subscribes to global, well-regarded news agencies. We have immense amounts of material coming out of Gaza from those news agencies. As far as I know, very few, if any, of the reporters doing that work are non-local Gazans. Most of them, again, as far as I know, are local Gazans. Maybe all of them are utterly committed to the most independent and objective and fair reporting that they can achieve. And maybe many of them are quite the reverse, are sympathizers with Hamas. I'm not making any accusation. I want to be really clear about this. I'm making the point that we don't know. Some immense amounts of material pouring out of Gaza, some of which you can, in retrospect, recognize as having been essentially accurate, and some of which you can recognize eventually, sooner or later, as being wide of the mark. And in real time, which is a lot of what journalism is, including our journalism, you can't always tell. So, for example, I just go back to for me, quite a major incident in this war, October the 17th, so 10 days after October the 7th, Hamas alleges that an Israeli bombing, has targeted a hospital, Al-Akhli Hospital, and that there are hundreds of dead. So an Israeli bombing, hundreds of dead. Very, very widely reported around the world, in some cases attributed to Hamas. This was the early days of the war, and many outlets, not ours, had not yet internalized that the health ministry in Gaza is essentially the Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza. So this was a Hamas claim. It was reported in some quarters as a Hamas claim, in other quarters as a statement of fact. We agonized about how to report it. We run a live blog, so we're doing stuff in real time. I'm not saying that we're always perfect either, but we did agonize and we tried to report it accurately, and we updated as the story was updated. Silence from Israel for a long time. The army said it was checking it. No official civilian comment. I kind of prefer, again, as an editor, I like the fact that the IDF spokesperson, that office, it seems to me, is trying to be credible. It didn't say, hey, we didn't do it, nothing to do with us. It said, we're checking. That's, you know, that means that when the subsequent account came from the IDF spokesperson of what actually happened, it was the more credible. But there was no official response from Israel, not even a civilian spokesperson standing up and saying, as a matter of policy, Israel does not target hospitals. We don't know if this was some kind of misfire by us or by somebody else. We are looking into it. But there was nothing. There was nothing except the army saying that we were checking it. So you had this landmark event widely reported as Israel killing hundreds of people. It wasn't true, actually, as it turned out. It was not an Israeli strike. It was a Palestinian Islamic Jihad rocket misfire. And the army eventually produced, not eventually, within a few hours, produced increasingly credible and well-established and well-founded evidence to suggest that. The American administration said it was able to confirm that that was the case. That particular story, quote-unquote, reached a sort of conclusion just a few days ago when the spokesman for Islamic Jihad, who's captured by Israel and was interrogated by Israel, the IDF released footage of him saying, yeah, of course, A, we did it, and B, we try to cover it up and blame it on the Israelis. That's a little landmark incident. It's so far from being the only one. It's so far. This is happening all the time. Material is coming out that is incredibly significant and unknowable. We could talk about death tolls. We could talk about the Hamas death toll. There's been reporting, I don't know what to make of it, that purports to statistically be able to prove that Hamas is lying about the death toll. I can't imagine why Hamas would not lie about the death toll, but I'm not a sufficient statistical expert to be able to determine whether it's provable in that particular framework. But Hamas is claiming, for example, right now, 33,000 or something Gazans have been killed in this conflict. We try to always remind readers that it's an unverifiable total and it doesn't distinguish between combatants and non-combatants. We don't know what definitions they use in terms of children. Is a 17, 18-year-old a child in Hamas's definitions? Well, 17 and 8-year-olds can certainly be potent threats if they have grenade launchers and guns and so on. Israel claims to have killed 13,000 people, fighters, gunmen, in Gaza. Fairly credible claim, I would have thought. We can't be certain of that either. Even in the much global reporting of this conflict, the fact that Israel asserts that it has killed 13,000 people is not always cited when the Hamas total is given. So, wait a minute, Israel's killed 33,000 people in Gaza. Oh, except that Israel says it's killed 13,000 gunmen and it's not confirming the 33,000. You know, we could go on and on about this, but even the most basic elements, when you're not particularly obsessed by a particular conflict, one of the things you look at is the death toll. And the death toll is not always, shall we say, credibly presented, even in outlets that are trying to be fair-minded. So again, you have a conflict with, you don't know the independence and veracity of material coming out from the war zone. Israel does take reporters, our reporters have been into Gaza, and it shows them what it wants to show them. Among other things, it doesn't take them into the heart of the worst areas of conflict because it would rather not get them killed. But it's, again, it's not as though reporters, I mean, one of this is the norm of a war, of course, but one of the issues is you have not got your own reporters or other independent, non-local reporters going around and seeing whatever it is they want to see. So it's an incredibly difficult conflict to report.
Right. As you said in your remarks on Gazan locals reporting on the war, and one would think that there could be some kind of bias. How do you feel that the Times of Israel is trying to overcome this bias? We are, of course, a proudly Zionist organization. That doesn't mean that we don't criticize every single move of every single government. But how do we overcome this bias, or at least attempt to?
Well, sure. I mean, in the same breath that I say there are local Gazans, well, I think almost all of the news agency copy out of Gaza is written by local Gazans. Hey, we're the Times of Israel. We live in Israel. Our reporters are covering this. We're Israelis. Our reporters do not work in a climate of fear. This country is not run by a terrorist organization that kills people for ostensibly collaborating with Israel, probably in many cases when they had nothing to do with Israel, in order to ensure that climate of fear. It's a totally different thing. You know, our biases and our mistakes and our failures, they're our own. There are honest failures, not imposed by a regime that limits our independence. In fact, nobody limits our independence at the Times of Israel, which we can talk about some more because it's pretty remarkable if you want to. But hey, we're an independent news organization in a democracy, a democracy where the people are pretty adamant about wanting to remain a democracy. Last time I checked, we had a free press here. We certainly act as an instrument of in an environment where we consider ourselves to be free, where our only framework is we want it to be right. We want it to be accurate. We're not meeting anybody's external expectations. We're not running content because somebody outside our news organization wants us to. We're not running content masquerading as genuine news reporting that is in fact paid for. We don't do any of those things. So, and so I speak of the Times of Israel in particular. More broadly speaking, the Israeli media is operating in it's certainly a democracy with strains, but it's operating in a democracy, not in an environment in which the government is a terrorist organization where the cost of being honest and critical can be fatal. We don't have that environment here, thank God.
We do have a free press, but it must be mentioned that we do have a censor, which is a military censor. And so we are sensitive to many issues when we're reporting. Speak about that a bit.
Yeah, look, it's can be a somewhat difficult relationship with the military censor, but it's, I think, broadly speaking, operates to an acceptable level given the protections of freedom and given the Israeli reality. So you have, I'll be very specific about this. You know, the way the military censor works in Israel is they actually, ever since, I don't know, 30 years ago, they don't have a practical means to prevent you from publishing anything. They have the potential to sanction you if you publish something that is ostensibly or judged to be deeply harmful to Israeli security, but they can't stop you. So there's a kind of working relationship where the censor sometimes alerts news outlets to, hey, we have this information circulating that we consider to be extremely harmful to Israeli security, and please check with us before you publish it, or please don't publish this. Some of this is the most basic and humane stuff. When people are killed and the military has not been able to alert the families that their loved one has been killed in this or that incident, Hebrew media, Israeli media, us, we don't even need to be told, actually. Wait at least for the families to be informed before you report this person, you know, God forbid, has been killed and so on. There are things, you know, we are not at liberty, for example, to specify how many soldiers are deployed at this or that place. There are circumstances in which you are, there are limitations on the reporting, the specific area where a missile may have fallen and something like that. It's a give and take relationship of relative mutual respect. And the crucial thing that I would add is that it's core regulated. In other words, if a news outlet such as us or any feels that the censor is exceeding its authority and is preventing publication for reasons that do not seem reasonable, like to me, for example, if the censor says, no, you can't run that, and I'm thinking, well, why not? I know it's not very convenient, or it makes you guys look bad, or I don't know, but that's not a legitimate reason. We have a means of appeal. You can go to the court, you can go to the much battered High Court of Justice hierarchy, all the way to the top if you need to in Israel. And the censor can be challenged, and our independent, still independent, again, thank goodness, still independent judiciary will intervene if it feels that the censor is exceeding its authority. And there have certainly been cases where there have been attempts by the military censor to try to prevent something, publication of something, and there have been petitions to the court, and the court has overruled the censor. That's the way things work in a healthy democracy.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic, because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
This war is also very much being fought on social media, including our own soldiers going into Gaza and recording themselves doing perhaps acts that are really reprehensible, such as playing with women's underwear in homes or putting slogans on buildings with spray paint and things like that. How much of that kind of material are you ready to include in our reporting?
We make judgments. I mean, we are a group of people with a hierarchy where people at all levels of that hierarchy have a fair amount of independence. I'm ultimately responsible for everything that gets published on the site. If I see something that I think is about to be published that I think is problematic, I might take a look. I mean, I will take a look. If I see something that has been published that I think is problematic, I'll deal with it. But we're all journalists. We're with greater and less experience trying to meet the demands and the standards that we've set for ourselves at the Times of Israel. As you said a few minutes ago, Amanda, we're called the Times of Israel. It's not a coincidental title. It's meant to underline, first of all, the Israel in that name for me doesn't only refer to the state of Israel, it refers to the sort of people, including the people who are part of the tribe of Israel, if you like, around the world. But I'm absolutely committed to the notion that the well-being of Israel as an independent, thriving democracy requires an independent, thriving media that reports Israel, warts and all. I get immense amounts of criticism from all over the political spectrum, from the Israeli left and the Israeli right, each of whom allege that we are the opposite of where they are. I think that's a necessary but not sufficient condition. In other words, if we didn't get it from all sides, I'd know we were doing something wrong, but getting it from all sides doesn't mean that we're doing everything right. But we try to do honest journalism that seeks the truth. And therefore, if there's a minor incident and there's 27 other things that are more significant, we might not get to it. We're a finite number of people. But if there is something that's significant that's going on, good or bad for the way people might look at Israel, we'll report it. The site enables us to curate material. We don't just publish it. No, there's a homepage and people, you know, the internet is a very interesting place. We can talk about that. But the strength of your homepage is not always an automatic feature in the internet of 2024. There are people who read articles all over the internet without ever going to the homepage of the site. We have very, very heavy traffic on our homepage. And one of the reasons for that is because it's a carefully curated homepage. We agonize. How high up the page should this be? Should this be the lead story? Do we like the headline? What module, what kind of graphical display are we giving to a piece? We make an analysis piece look different graphically, design-wise, to a news piece. A feature looks different still. Our blogs platform, those are opinion pieces. They look different too. Where are they placed on the homepage? How long do they stay? How high with how large a headline, right? These are decisions that are taken all the time, 24/7, ultimately by the person who's running the Times of Israel. At the time that an article is published or moved around. And our readership has, I mean, you know, I'm not really schwitzing here. I'm kind of trying to tell you the facts. We have an immense amount of traffic on the homepage partly because of that. It's not only, hey, here's a story that I happen to see. No, here's a website that is prioritizing and showing me what it thinks matters most. That's really, really central to what we do.
I want to shift back into some of the issues of the war. And one of the narratives that is very difficult to unpick is the idea of the humanitarian aid and the lack of it and the famine. And of course, Israel saying there is unlimited ability to bring in humanitarian aid, and yet it's just not going in and it's not being distributed. And this is really disturbing for many of the people who write into me. So how do we unpick this knot? We're hearing different things from different parts of official Israel. How do we understand?
Look, it's part of the same issue that we spoke about before. You know, it's the fog of war. And in some cases, it's the deliberate fog of war. And in some cases, it's the not terribly efficient release of information regarding what's going on. Yeah, conflicting material all the time, including from people whose job it is to give you the facts and to make sure that they're responsible for the facts, and a situation in which the people who you'd like to think would only be giving accurate information, well, somebody must be failing in that because you've got contradictory information. So we try to get to the bottom of it. And within the limitations, you can't get on an aid truck and go into Gaza and see what happens to it. You can try and work out what became of this or that truck. And when there are terrible incidents, as there have been, well, exactly what happened here, I'm not sure. I'm certainly not sure that as of now, we know exactly what has happened in some of the main incidents where, for example, there was, dozens of people were killed in some kind of stampede where there was gunfire surrounding one particular truck in a large convoy not so many weeks ago. You have the UN making allegations about Israel in essence still limiting the amount of humanitarian aid going into Gaza, and you have COGAT, which is the Israeli organization essentially responsible for aid deliveries and so on, asserting, in fact, there's unlimited aid, there's more going in, or more cleared by Israel to go in than is being distributed. In the last few days, allegations by the UN that lots of these trucks that Israel says are going in and is talking about the high numbers are, in fact, half empty. Israeli counter accusations that in fact it's the UN that is failing in the distribution and the other organizations, all the complexities of the main welfare agency in Gaza being UNRWA, with which Israel has a decades-long history of dissatisfaction, would be putting it mildly. Basically, Israel alleges that UNRWA is part of the problem, not part of the solution, that it perpetuates the Palestinian refugee issue in unique criteria that don't apply to refugees anywhere else in the world. The Israeli argument broadly would be, in specific as it relates to Gaza, Israel has no claims on Gaza. That is independent Palestinian territory. If Gaza had been calm, Israel would not be there. Believe me, the Israeli, I'll say this, Israeli officialdom, military and political, was so desperate not to want to get re-entangled in Gaza that it refused to believe that Hamas was about to attack it in the weeks and months before October the 7th. So, you know, on that issue, that is one of the most central areas of what on earth is going on. You know, there's been radical Israeli shifts in policy, I would say, on aid, in that the defense minister at the very beginning proudly said, we're not letting any aid into Gaza. And the defense minister yesterday, as far as I recall, said, there are no limits and we're going to flood Gaza with aid. And so the same person has proudly advanced totally opposite policies. I'm not even saying that as a criticism. I'm just saying that's the way it is. And you're trying to get to the bottom of what exactly is going on. By the way, I'm not even making a comment about what the right or the wrong policies are on this, although you're welcome to ask me. But it underlines what kind of mixed signals, how the picture shapes, all the frictions, all the antagonism between authorities and organizations. We're in a war. And, you know, all the cliches about truth being the first casualty. So at the times of Israel, and I know at many, many well-intentioned and capable media organizations, we're trying to, you know, make sure that the harm to truth is minimal, that we can be as accurate and fair as we can. But it's never been more of a challenge than it has been for me, certainly for the Times of Israel, certainly never more of a challenge than it has been in the last few months.
So we don't have editorials at the Times of Israel, but you write a weekly column and op-eds whenever you are struck by the muse. And you are very overt with your opinion. How do you feel like that affects the news organization as a whole?
It's a very good question. The muse, I don't know, it's not a muse. It's a sense of obligation. And I try to write when I think that there's something important that needs to be said that isn't being said. That's a big thing for me. I feel very conscious that we do very, very serious news reporting, and making sense and trying to understand how serious something is, or how much this or that matters, and how resonant these developments are, I think that one step back is really important. I think when you're not in Israel and or you don't speak Hebrew, you need context as well as facts. And that's one of the things that I try to do, to enable people. I know all that happened, but, you know, how serious is it? How significant is it? What does it signify? And so on. In terms of the fact that I do express opinions, I'm certain that because I'm the editor, it colors the way people look at the site. At the same time, and you please feel free to disagree with me, I do not try to impose opinions on our news coverage. In fact, I go even further. I don't even know the Israeli political partisan beliefs and opinions of the people who do our reporting, and I don't want to, and I don't want it to be obvious from the reporting that they do. And that's the environment in which people operate. And we're, you know, healthily contentious, maybe that's not the right word. We're an environment in which we have editorial meetings and we have people speak their minds and people say, hey, why haven't we done a story on this? This seems very important. Or why did we cover this in this way? Seems to me we missed the mark. Have we taken into account A, B, and C, including on some of the issues that we discussed already about, you know, coverage from Gaza and what we're reporting and what we're being careful about and so on. You know, this is a I'm probably the last person who should be answering in this way, but it's meant to be an environment in which people can venture their opinions on our coverage to make sure that we are pulling together and trying to do the fairest job that we can do. In terms of the things that I write, which I'm not sure you actually asked me, but I'm going to say that as well, I'm kind of conscious as well. I feel a tremendous weight of responsibility. I care deeply about this country, as everybody who works here does. We are Israelis. We are almost everyone here is based in Israel, is an Israeli citizen. We are ordinary people who do journalism for a living in the middle of a war. Whereas we said at the very beginning of this conversation, you know, the country is in some, I think, existential peril. I was very wary in the early weeks and even months of the war in pieces very clearly marked as op-ed opinion pieces. I had been less critical than I wanted to be, than I felt was justified of the political leadership. And especially the prime minister who helms Israel and who has run Israel almost the entire time that that Hamas was running Gaza. I don't want to fuel and fan flames of division, but I do want people to understand how high those flames are rising. And that for me was, you know, that was a hard path to walk or to write. So, you know, again, it's not something you asked me about, but since we're having an incredibly candid conversation, which is somewhat uncomfortable for me, but I think very important. So I wrote a piece yesterday about Netanyahu and resignation and so on. One of the reasons I wrote that was because there's a rising sort of tide overseas, essentially asserting with varying degrees of definitive instruction that the prime minister must go. And there was a column by Brett Stevens in the New York Times yesterday, who was an editor of the Jerusalem Post, and I actually succeeded him as editor of the Jerusalem Post. He knows Israel very well, and he wrote a piece. You know, basically, that was the headline: Netanyahu must go. I think that's the headline. I wanted to. I thought, well, you know what? I really have to address this now. This is the prime minister of Israel. And, you know, Chuck Schumer has basically said the same thing, although not in exactly those terms. You have a president in the United States, our key ally, who's basically said for a long time that he thinks that this government in Israel, the alliance that Netanyahu built in order to win re-election, to get back into power at the end of 2022, contains figures. I mean, Biden has actually named Itamar Ben-Gvir, who are detrimental to Israel's interests, to put it mildly. I didn't think that what had been written on this was sufficient. I wanted to make the point that saying Netanyahu should go, to me, it's something you ought to take for granted. And why do I say that? Because you have presided over the most catastrophic failure of the leadership of Israel to protect its citizens from enemy attack. And by the way, as a courtesy, as an obligation to the public, it seems to me that Netanyahu, from very early on, after it became clear what had happened, was obligated to say to the public, of course, as the person who had all the information, had the best overview of all the policies, given what has happened, I will, of course, step down. I will step down when the moment is right, when it is least harmful to Israel. I'm not even sure he needed to say, and I will never run for office again, but I will step down and give the public the opportunity to choose a leadership again. I thought that was, there's a Hebrew word, mitbakesh, it was like obligatory. I mean, it's a terrible failure, and therefore you take responsibility. So not only has he not done that, he's in fact really, and there are so many examples that I don't even want to go into it because it's to belabor the point of him trying to pass responsibility, to blame people, to return to this instinct he has for division. And forgive me, this is a lengthy conversation. So, you know, I'll give an incident that to me was really, it's not a big incident. In fact, I'll cite you two, but they're so emblematic. He was asked one week at a press. We used to complain that he didn't give press conferences and didn't answer questions. Now I don't know which is worse, that he does give press conferences and he does answer questions. I'm sorry if that sounds bitter, but that's how I feel. So one week he was asked about whether he wears the dog tag of bring the hostages home. And he obviously wasn't wearing it, which, by the way, I do not think is a crime. And therefore he couldn't show it. And the following week, he obviously had planted a question with a obsequious reporter who asked him, and wordlessly, with a smirk, he opened his collar and produced the dog tag. I mean, the preparation required for that dramatic act, I thought was, I found that unsavory. Worse for me was shortly after that, he has a mantra about, I understand the division of labor, I'll fight Hamas, and you in the media, you'll fight me. He said that several times at press conferences. Okay, you don't like the media, they give you a hard time, you're the prime minister, I'm sure you can deal with it, right? But he was asked in one of his press conferences something about, I'll tell you exactly what in a second, but the reporter prefaced the question by saying, I've just come back from reserve duty, months of reserve duty in my combat unit on the front. And I have to ask you, Prime Minister, why is it that your government continues to fund organizations that are enabling, he basically was talking about the Haredi community, not to do military service? So you've got a journalist who's left his job for, I don't know how many months, has been in a combat unit, asking the Prime Minister a question. And you'd think a modicum of care for the fabric of your society and the reservists and the standing army putting lives on the line to try and protect this country, you'd think that would be enough to prevent you from repeating your mantra about the media being out to get you while you're trying to fight Hamas. But no, Netanyahu responded to that question, first of all, by saying that thing about, I understand your question is coming from a bad place because you're a journalist and that's the division of labor. I am fighting Hamas and you're fighting me. Well, this journalist was obviously actually had been fighting Hamas, or maybe he was on the Northern Front. I don't know for sure. So you have a prime minister who cannot help but be divisive, who is trying to shift blame. And I felt an obligation to say, of course, the prime minister ought to have taken responsibility and indicated that he would step down. And it requires, since he's not going to go, and since he has a majority, by definition, it will require people within his coalition to make clear to him that that's what he needs to do. But, and this was the point that I was trying to make, it needs to be done in a way that is least harmful to Israel, right? We don't want to create a situation in which we are tearing ourselves apart for months in ways that help the people who are trying to wipe this country out. And by the way, there are legal provisions within Israel for coalition reshuffles, for somebody to hand over power. You don't even need to have an election campaign. So what I was actually trying to do was explain or put into a more constructive context what I think is the obligatory call for Netanyahu to step down. It doesn't need to presage an incredibly divisive, months-long bitter, because it would be a very bitter political campaign. Can we go about doing this? Can we indicate to him that that's really what he ought to do and do it in a way that minimizes harm to the war effort and gives, as I said, gives our enemies cause not for jubilation, but for concern. Whoa, the Israelis, they're getting it together. People are taking responsibility. There's a more consensual coalition in power now that can act in a way that more broadly represents the needs of the country rather than resting on certain extremist forces in the coalition and so on. So that was why I thought it was important to write that.
Our time is very long so far.
Yeah, because I keep giving these long answers, Amanda. Sorry.
I love the passion, and I think it's very important that people hear it, because this is what drives the Times of Israel, the passion and the obligation to bring this to our readers and our listeners. But I just want to ask one question. We criticize so strongly other people who call for our prime minister, who is democratically elected, to step down. David, you're in a way doing the same thing. But do you feel that by being Israeli, you have the right to do it?
First of all, I don't know who the we is at the beginning of that sentence. We criticize people. Who's the we? Our news reporters don't. We have opinion pieces that certainly have done.
Sure. But when, for example, President Joe Biden, or when, for example, Chuck Schumer has given their very strong statements about the, okay, Schumer, for example, putting Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu within four obstacles of peace alongside, for example, Hamas, I think there is some criticism made from the Times of Israel about that statement.
I'm sure that there are, we have run opinion pieces that have made those criticisms. I'm sure we've had news articles in which Israeli officials and others have alleged that this was an unwarranted effort at intervention in Israeli politics. I myself have, indeed, I'll come back to the end of your question there about being Israeli or otherwise. It's also being a journalist or otherwise, right? Allied governments are not meant to be telling democratic allies who their leaders ought to be. I think that's certainly something that deserves criticism. Editors of newspapers and news sites that cover Israel, who are themselves Israeli, I think have an obligation to weigh in on issues relating to who should be governing the country. So, I think all of those things that we in our various roles here have done are legitimate and necessary. And me thinking that Netanyahu had and has an obligation to say to the country, of course, I am ultimately responsible. I, at the very least, will be stepping down to allow you. You want to elect me again, but to allow you to the chance, or to allow my colleagues to form an alternative coalition in the short term, some kind of process of accepting responsibility. I think that's a very legitimate call. It doesn't contradict what I believe. I think it was unwarranted to have listed Netanyahu in the same breath as the other three elements that he mentioned. I think it was disingenuous, to put it mildly, and problematic for the US to allow through a resolution at the UN last month that did not condition a ceasefire call on the release of hostages. I think there are lots of areas for criticism. And yes, I certainly think that it's more, I'm not saying that people outside Israel don't have the right. I mean, people have the right to say and do what they want. I think, the Jerusalem-based editor of an Israeli-based publication that is concerned for the well-being of this country has an obligation to weigh in on things like that.
David, thank you so much for giving me so much for your time today.
Thanks, Amanda. Thank you for putting me to the test there. It was atypical for me to speak on many of these issues, and very important, I think. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to What Matters Now. Please check out another installment next week. This episode was produced by The Podwaves. Until next week, shalom.